from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. We are broadcasting live today from the State House in Montpelier, and got a good show lined up for you today. We're going to be talking mainly about environmental issues. In fact, I think purely about environmental issues. We are getting to the end of a week in which it looks like there'll be House and Senate passage finally of the latest round of minimum wage and paid family leave legislation. But we're going to leave that aside for now. Those bills are both in jeopardy, it seems, of another gubernatorial veto, and perhaps we'll revisit where we are on those next week. They're still in a little bit of a state of flux right now. I wanted to really dig into some of the environmental issues, though, that lawmakers are dealing with this session, and we're going to talk some about Act 250. Later in the program, we'll be joined by Representative Amy Sheldon of Middlebury. She's chair of the House Natural Resources Committee and been digging in on reforming the 50-year-old or 51-year-old now maybe land use law for the state of Vermont, Act 250, and we'll be finding out what's being cooked up there. We're going to be talking to Representative Tim Briglin also in the second hour of the program about some climate legislation, the Global Warming Solutions Act. Chris Bray will be stopping by in the second part of the first hour to talk with us about some work being done in the Senate Natural Resources Committee about the idea of an all-fuels energy efficiency program. We'll be finding out a little bit about that from Senator Bray. But first, I wanted to get an overview of what all the different moving parts are on environmental legislation. And I thought, who better to go to for that than the environmental writer for vtdigger.org, Elizabeth Gribkoff, joins me for the first part of our show this morning. Elizabeth, thanks so much for coming in.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
And we are sitting here just outside the State House cafeteria, as we like to do on Friday mornings on the Dave Graham Show, and round up. Usually, I like to start with a journalist and bring in some legislators to get caught up on what's been happening here. So, Elizabeth, there is a big environmental agenda this session. Is there not? Or is it bigger than the last couple of years?
Yeah, I would say so. I think where a lot of the focus really is this session is on climate change legislation in a way that we haven't quite seen in mm-hmm. recent years.
And what are the big moving parts there?
Okay, so there's this one bill that you mentioned called the Global Warming Solutions Act, and right now that's in House Energy and Technology, which is chaired by Timothy Briglin, and that essentially would make Vermont has these greenhouse gas pollution reduction goals, but we've not been meeting them at all. In fact, we've been far exceeding them in recent years.
And so, actually losing ground on not moving toward them, but away from them.
Right, exactly. The latest greenhouse gas emissions data from 2016 showed a slight decline, but it's still, you know, way above where the state's supposed to be in by statute. And so this law, essentially what it would do is make kind of update those goals and make them required instead of sort of goals, make them mandatory.
Mandatory requirements as opposed to goals, yeah.
Yeah, and it would essentially, it would create this panel to kind of look into ways to, okay, how can we actually reduce emissions, but it would basically, the State Agency of Natural Resources would have to write rules with the aim of actually achieving those emissions reductions. But they're pretty ambitious. Like the first one is a 26% reduction by 2025.
Okay, but again, in recent years, we've actually been backsliding on this. I mean, there was some progress made in the early part of this century, from what I recall, mainly in the electrical sector. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, Vermont Yankee closed down, which was a source of low carbon, not carbon-free electricity, but low carbon electricity. And since then, the state has been actually generating more carbon on an annual basis.
Yeah, and especially in kind of the single biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions comes from the transportation sector, not surprisingly, and that's really where I think Vermont just hasn't seen a lot of reductions in emissions, because we're a state where a lot of people drive, and you know, there's not tons of affordable electric vehicles yet, so that's really been an area where progress hasn't been made.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, in terms of anybody moving more to public transit, or I haven't noticed any significant you know, reduction in traffic on the highways and the streets or anything in Vermont in recent times. If anything,
no.
If anything, it seems like there's more traffic as I drive up to Waterbury in the morning to do the radio show. Or, I mean, it's so we're really what's supposed to change here that's going to suddenly put the brakes on here and say, okay, we're not worsening the problem anymore. We're improving on the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, you know, both Scott and lawmakers last session actually put in place Vermont's first state electric vehicle incentive to try to, you know, really encourage people to switch over to electric vehicles. But, you know, it was something, I forget the exact amount, but it was a bit over a million. And if you, like, look at the pace of what would have to happen, it's just, it's hard to see how it would realistically...
A drop in the ocean, shall we say?
That, yeah. it's, and also just in terms of even people, you know, actually taking that up or finding, you know, wanting to switch out their internal combustion engine vehicles for electric vehicles. I think there's interest in that, but it's just not happening at the pace that it would need to achieve those kinds of reductions.
Yeah, do we know what percentage of vehicles sold in Vermont are... Electric vehicles now, and if there's a curve there or anything?
You know what? I know that it is increasing. Like, if you look at the graph, it's going up. But then if you actually look at what the numbers are compared to total vehicles, I think it's only, like, I want to say it's, like, 3%. I'm probably doing quite a bit right, but it's around that. So it's still...
Low single digits.
Yeah.
Sounds like.
It's not, like, 50%. Yeah. It's.
And what is the... Is there a goal for... in other words, what is the state... What would the state like to shoot for on that front?
Oh man, there is a goal, and I don't remember it offhand, but it's the goal is far, far above the pace that we're that we're moving at for electric vehicles.
So, what are the best ideas people have for kind of kickstarting this and getting us closer to closer to the goal, or at least sort of bending the curve, or I don't know exactly.
Well, I think one idea, because obviously, you know, part of the issue, a lot of it's behavioral change, but also part of it is just the initial funding to do some of these things, whether it's get into an electric vehicle or, you know, weatherize your home or put in a cold climate heat pump instead of, you know, relying on propane heat, etc. But a lot of that stuff does have this upfront price tag that, you know, a lot of people are balking at. And one sort of way that lawmakers, not just in Vermont, but in states throughout the Northeast, are hoping maybe they can get some of that funding from is through this program called the Transportation and Climate Initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And so that basically, I think it's 12 states in it, and D.C., and it would basically, it kind of builds off something we already have in the electric sector called REGI, which sort of helps electric power generators make some greenhouse gas emission reductions, and it would essentially... people who, you know, sort of, I guess, high upstream in the market who sell, you know, import oil into the region and gas would have to, they'd have to buy these allowances at auctions. And essentially what ended up happening is it's likely that a lot of those costs kind of would get passed on to consumers, you know, somewhere between like 5 and 17 cents on a gallon of gas. And that money would be kind of then reallocated back to states, and they could then invest it in really a broad array of, you know, kind of greenhouse gas emissions and public health things.
Yeah, with the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, the famous REGI program,
right.
I guess the state has been able to ratchet down carbon emissions from, and the Northeast really has been able to ratchet down carbon emissions from what they were when REGI took effect 10 or 15 years ago. And I guess the idea is to apply that to transportation in a way that says the states will have goals of trying to reduce the carbon emissions from transportation now and have cash incentives, their financial incentives, the money that would be raised, I gather, from these new, effectively what the critics are calling a gasoline tax. And I think there's a point there. I mean, I think people ought to be honest about what we're doing here. This would be, even though it would be hitting the wholesale level up, as you say, upstream in the market, so you wouldn't see it actually rack up on the gas pump as you're pumping your gas. But when the shippers of petroleum products into Vermont have to pay a new fee or a new tax or whatever they want to call it, it's an increased cost to those shippers, and they want to recoup their costs from consumers. So,
right. I think a lot of some people are arguing, you know, when you look at the sort of just the fluctuation in gas prices generally, like this would really probably barely be a blip in that. There's so many factors that you use in setting prices, but I think that thinking that it wouldn't have some kind of an impact is, you know, is a bit naive. But also the proceeds from this, I believe they don't just necessarily have to go back into the transportation sector. I think states can really apply it pretty broadly to like what would most make sense for their residents, since you have states like, you know, Vermont and Maine that are really rural and have very different needs than, say, Massachusetts.
But would they be directed toward carbon reductions, or could they be put in the general fund and
There's definitely some restrictions, but the way it is right now, I mean, it's also still kind of being negotiated, so it's pretty broad. But
we're in the early stages here, that's for sure.
And we've seen Scott thus far has been, you know, he's been saying he just wanted Vermont to have a seat at the table, but he's been pretty clear that if this amounts to what, you know, seems to him to be like a carbon tax, he's not gonna get his support.
I mean, that would be a tough hurdle. I understand that Governor Chris Sununu in New Hampshire also has recently said he doesn't have any interest in going here. And that actually sets up the old Vermont-New Hampshire dynamic, of course, which is a big bugaboo for folks from the Connecticut River Valley, where already today, if you're driving around the Northeast Kingdom and slip across the river to Littleton, New Hampshire, you're going to pay less for gas there than you would pay in, say, St. Johnsbury, typically, by a significant amount. This would make that more so, right, if New Hampshire decides not to do this and Vermont does?
You know, it probably would. I heard an interesting argument when I was sitting in Senate Transportation a couple weeks ago about this, because I forget who it was, but someone was making kind of that exact point. And then Senator Tim Ash was like, well, you know, basically, like, if a state like just New Hampshire sort of decided not to join, he was saying, do we really think these large regional oil importers are going to keep costs low in New Hampshire and then raise them X amount in every other state around it? He was like, no, they're going to just... He was saying that he thinks if Vermont didn't participate but other states did, we'd still see the slightly higher prices on gas, but wouldn't be getting the benefits of having that money actually flow back into the state, if that makes sense. I thought that was kind of interesting.
I guess the other thing to the argument you could probably launch in favor of this is to say, you're right, we have seen big fluctuations in the price of gas over time. It'll drop, you know, half a dollar sometimes and come back up 75 cents and back down 37 cents as an average gasoline price in Vermont, just by sheer market fluctuations. You know, one friend who was I was talking to about this a couple weeks ago said, yeah, I've seen gas prices go up 17 cents and, you know, over the course of a week in the past, and I've never gotten any benefit in terms of, you know, trying to do stuff to reduce carbon emissions from it.
Yeah, but so, it's right. But it is a complicated program, and I think especially in, it's interesting because actually Governor Baker in Massachusetts, who in some ways, you know, Scott and him are both like somewhat more moderate Republicans, but obviously he's dealing with a very different situation, and Boston, you know, really needs funding for public transit. He actually has been really supportive, like one of the most active proponents of TCI, because he really wants to use that funding to go back into their public transit system, which they really need a major injection in. But Vermont, you know, it's such a different dynamic. Like, we don't have this huge...
We don't have the T up here.
Yeah, exactly. So it's been kind of interesting seeing that.
Although Dave Littersdorf would probably love it if we did, but he's a big advocate for rail, of course, in Vermont, and public transportation. The Global Warming Solutions Act and the Transportation Climate Initiative, these are actually two separate pieces of legislation, right?
Yes, they are. Though the TCI, as far as I know, the Transportation and Climate Initiative is still very much something that's in the talking about it stage, but I don't, I could be wrong. I don't think it's, last time I checked in with it, it wasn't in a specific bill yet.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It's more that this draft regional agreement came out in December, and now is when states kind of have to decide, okay, do we want to join on to this or not? So the legislature's looking at it. You know, the governor's been looking at it.
And is there a path for involvement by the legislature here? Does the legislature have to sign off on it? Can it? Would, I mean, if the legislature were so made up and motivated to, could they actually pass a law saying the governor shall not join this agreement, or must join the agreement?
I believe that they can. I'm still trying to figure out how that all works, but I'm pretty sure that they can pass a law that's like Vermont has to join on to this. And I think that they're, I mean, both Tim and Mitzi have expressed interest in this, but I think that there's, it seems like there's a lot of questions that lawmakers still have about it.
Tim and Mitzi, of course, Tim Ashley, President Pro Tem of the Senate, Mitzi Johnson, the Speaker of the House, and I think that there's a lot of push on right now, especially from many of the rank and file legislators here on the committees that are of jurisdiction, natural resources, mm-hmm. Energy and technology. They're pretty gung-ho to do something about climate change. They don't like the fact that Vermont is slipping from its goals and sort of, you know, getting worse when it's supposed to be getting better. And so I do think that there is a fair amount of pressure, really, on the legislative leadership kind of bubbling up from the ranks. Is that a good way to describe it, or do you think that the leadership is really grabbing the bull by the horns and taking these issues on more directly?
I think that's a good way to describe it. I think there's also a lot of, we've seen a lot of, over the past year, protests at the State House and out of the State House from Vermonters kind of wanting more action on climate change. I mean, we've also seen some protests going the other way, like against a carbon tax. But I think that a lot of lawmakers are still concerned about, okay, how do we do this in a way that's going to be, to not have to, you know, raise a bunch of taxes, and everyone's kind of scratching their heads about how to do that.
A little of this, I mean, sometimes I think, are they really looking for a sort of no-pain solution here? That's the other question that you have. Of course, that's oftentimes what the goal is.
Well, and actually, it's interesting that you say that, because I think this all-fuels efficiency program, mm-hmm. which, I mean, again, that's also something that's still in the early stages. There's a committee bill now, and then the Senate Natural Resources Committee that they're talking about.
Right.
But that, basically, the general idea behind that, and this was, there was a bill passed last session kind of directing the State Public Utility Commission to look into this. So this isn't a brand new discussion this session, but it basically would make Efficiency Vermont, and then also Burlington Electric and Vermont Gas, which are more localized energy efficiency utilities. Right now, the bulk of their work really focuses on making the electricity sector more efficient, or, you know, like having more energy efficient appliances in people's homes, etc. But since most of Vermont's greenhouse gas emissions come from transportation and heating, there's a lot of interest in, well, hey, maybe we should expand what these energy efficiency utilities can do. Visions Vermont already does some, you know, building weatherization with a certain set of money, but most of their funds, which come from electric ratepayers, cannot.
Yeah.
It can't go back toward that. So I think that there's pretty broad interest in kind of modernizing, if you will, how Efficiency Vermont works, and using it to really
its footprint. We're going to be talking later in the show about the Transportation Climate Initiative and the Global Warming Solutions Act with Tim Briglin, the chair of the House Energy and Technology Committee. We're also going to be talking with Amy Sheldon, the chair of the House Natural Resources Committee, and Representative Jim McCullough about the some changes to Act 250. So, but let's give a preview of that, if we could, right now in the last few minutes of this segment, Elizabeth. And what are you hearing about this? What is the gist of what's going on with Act 250 right now?
Well, there's been, as you're saying, for a couple years now that it's the 50th anniversary of Vermont's major land use law, and there's kind of been this desire to, okay, we're in the 21st century, let's modernize this, let's make it more efficient, let's take into account some things that we weren't really taking into account in the 70s, like climate change. So there's been this big effort to overhaul this bill, and so the House Natural Resources Committee has been working on this. They started last session with like a bill that's, you know, more than 80 pages long, so obviously it's been taking some time. And some of the main ideas behind this effort are you know, let's maybe have Act 250 apply less in downtown areas where we know we kind of want to encourage development, and have it in some ways apply maybe a little more stringently in areas we really want to protect, like higher elevation areas. And that's kind of one idea. And that's actually something that this year, in an interesting sort of pairing, Phil Scott's administration and Vermont Natural Resources Council kind of joined together and put forward, I guess, like a draft bill that would do some of that stuff. So they actually paired together, which you wouldn't necessarily expect to see.
That was interesting. I mean, one of the things they're doing also, though, is they do I understand correctly, they want to eliminate the regional Act 250 commissions, the district commission level of review, have sort of a statewide board. Is it fair to analogize it to like the Public Utility Commission?
I guess in a way it would be. There would still be regional representatives, and a lot of the, you know, kind of more minor applications, which are the majority of what go through Act 250, would still be looked at this regional level. But then for more major projects, which are the ones that, you know, have to go through the public hearing process, and really I think what people think of when they think of Act 250 review, that would actually be decided on by this statewide board. Because I think one of the concerns that some people have had about how Act 250 works is that, you know, it's so dependent on kind of who's, you know, on the commission by regions.
Yeah.
That would get approved.
It varies from different parts of the state.
Right, and part of that, I mean, some people argue, well, you know, different parts of the state are different, and we want that local control, but...
All right, well, there's lots more to talk about. We'll have to have Elizabeth Gribkoff of vtdigger.org back. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining me this morning. And the... we're going to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News. Back shortly with more of the Dave Graham Show. Stay with us, folks.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot, and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes, or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back, and we are talking about environmental issues as they're playing out here at the State House in Montpelier. We're broadcasting from, as we do on Friday mornings here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. I want to once again thank Elizabeth Gribkoff, the environmental writer for BT Digger, not only for the fact that she's, I think, the only full-time environmental reporter in Vermont these days. What a responsibility, and she's filling it well. She does a lot of great stories for BT Digger. Well worth checking out that website to keep up with what's going on here in Vermont. But I appreciate Elizabeth taking a little time out of that very busy schedule she's got to come by in the first half hour here. Speaking of busy schedules, Christopher Bray is chair of the Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committee, and he works a long, hard day over here under the Golden Dome, too, when the legislature is in session. But he also is kind enough to take a little time this morning to sit down on the couch here on the outside the State House cafeteria and visit with the Dave Graham Show. And Senator Bray, thanks so much for joining me.
Good to see you again. Nice to be here.
And you have something interesting you're working on. I wanted to dig into a little bit and find out a little bit about just first what it is, and then it's kind of what its prospects are for enactment this year, if that's going to happen, and so on. And this is the idea of an all-fuels energy efficiency program. Vermont's been famous for its energy efficiency programs around electricity for about 20 years now, since the creation of Efficiency Vermont back at the turn of the millennium. We're thinking about broadening that picture now?
Exactly. You know, we've achieved great things through Efficiency Vermont. In the last 18 years or so, Vermonters have invested about $650 million into energy efficiency programs just for electricity, and they're saving us about $2.4 billion over the lifetime. So we have a great track record. It's been cost effective, and what we have is we've reduced how much electrical energy we do, but if you look at the climate change challenge we're all facing, we know that 80% of the emissions related to energy come from the two other sectors where Efficiency Vermont's not allowed to work. One of them is transportation. They can't do any work in the transportation field, and they can do very little in the world of weatherization and thermal. So,
thermal by the heating of buildings and homes and businesses,
yeah.
Basically.
Heating and cooling, although most of us in Vermont are always thinking about how do we stay warm.
Yeah, right. Funny thing about that, right. Especially this time of year. Right. But you're right, there is an increasing air conditioning load, and that may actually increase over time as if our temperatures get warmer right. In the summer because of climate change. So that could be a phenomenon here.
Right.
Anyway, this is interesting stuff. Now, in terms of the electricity, give me those figures again. It was
about $650 million.
Okay, and that's been invested mainly through the little addendum to one's utility bill, which talks about an efficiency charge.
Right.
And typically a few dollars every month added to your electric bill. All of that over the 20 years has added up to $650 million.
Yeah.
And the same 20-year period for the
$2.4 billion
yep.
in benefit. So,
okay.
You know, everyone knows part of the Vermont mindset is frugality, right? Don't waste, not want not. So we have shifted. If you think back when we all had incandescent bulbs,
mm-hmm.
there's a 60-watt bulb. Efficiency Vermont helped everyone move to compact fluorescents. So you get the same amount of light. 60 became, like a 20. And now you can shift to an LED and it's only 10 watts. So things have gotten much more efficient. And we've done that same thing in electric motors, refrigerant, cooling systems, all sorts of areas. And it's paid big benefits. So the obvious thing was, here we have this giant climate challenge. How do we attack all greenhouse gas emissions from these two big sectors, transportation and thermal? Well, you look around for tools you already have. And one of the great tools we have with this great track record is Efficiency Vermont. So mm-hmm. what we're trying to do is say, we're not going to have any new taxes. We're not going to have any new mandates. We're just going to take a great tool we already have and create an opportunity for Vermonters to say, hey, how can you help me, for instance, reduce my heating costs at home? Or can you help me meet my transportation needs more efficiently?
Let's tackle the home and business heating,
yeah.
Space heating, we'll call it, for thermal, whatever the terminology,
yeah.
For the next few minutes. And because I can imagine that what is being envisioned here, if you sort of analogize from the model, I mean, Efficiency Vermont has been out there offering cash incentives and other programs to try to encourage people to say when you're swapping out your, getting your old refrigerator breaks down, it's time to get a new one. We want you to get the most energy efficient model you can afford that's on the market. And here are some incentives to do that. Here's some information to guide you in your decision about that, et cetera, et cetera. So it sounds like we're talking now about when someone is contemplating a new heating system because they're about to get done with hauling wood in from the barn.
Yes.
The Efficiency Vermont then steps in and says, here's the best technology for energy saving, for efficiency in terms of getting your best bang for the energy input and also getting your best bang for the buck.
Right. So because Efficiency Vermont starts with that charge that's on the electric bill,
mm-hmm.
what we are being careful to do is say, okay, if you're going to be taking money that comes out of electrical consumption, and now you're going to start spending it on something like a heating load or transportation, you should only bring those dollars over and apply them to something that's electrically based. So that's why it might be something like a cold climate heat pump that starts heating your home rather than an oil fire boiler or something like that. Or that you're using a plug-in hybrid electric or full electric car rather than putting gas in the tank.
Well, that's interesting. That raises an interesting question, which I'm just sort of formulating as we talk here.
That always worries me when I see that.
You see the wheels turning, but suppose we had a situation where somebody came out with an oil burner that was just amazingly efficient and was actually, in terms of getting the best bang for the energy input and the best bang for the buck, that might actually be superior. I'm not saying there's anything like that now, but superior to the current sort of state-of-the-art of cold climate heat pumps, right? Now, those are based in electricity, coal climate heat pumps.
Yes.
This new technology comes out based on, you know, oil or propane or boiler, who knows?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, would there be a barrier to having Efficiency Vermont help promote this other technology that might even be better?
Well, we would have to. Probably we might have to make a statutory adjustment to allow them to make such an investment. But in general, Efficiency Vermont, you know, sometimes people think of it as just one thing that's always been doing the same thing. Oh, light bulbs. But in fact, Efficiency Vermont has a whole suite of services, and it's been evolving every year for 20 years. What we're doing now in this Energy Efficiency Modernization Act says, let's run a three-year experiment and see how much progress we can make in heating and in transportation by bringing their toolkit to the table.
One of the things that they do, I know, is advise businesses on stuff, frankly, that a lot of people have never heard of, because we're talking about now a highly technical process use of energy in manufacturing, let's say, right?
Sure.
And if I'm running this manufacturing plant, obviously there are different ways I can heat my system to do whatever the kind of manufacturing is that I'm trying to do. I can use electricity, I can use fossil fuel.
Right.
And in some applications, from what I understand, fossil fuel is still more efficient when you're trying to get very high temperatures for a manufacturing process, for instance, right?
You know, I'm not a tech that they do offer. You're absolutely right. So Efficiency Vermont offers technical assistance for people to figure out the best solution for their business, just like they do that for best solution for your home.
Yeah.
And it's not a one-size-fits-all solution. So I think my understanding from talking with people is, yeah, if it turns out that there's not an electric solution that's best for you, then they are going to point out that it's an alternative, and that might be the way for you to go.
Okay. So there's no like gag rule to say you can't talk about propane or oil or anything else. You've got to talk just about electricity.
As best I know, their technical assistance is neutral. I mean, what their programs are designed to do is find the most efficient solution using electric options, because that's the nature of their funding stream.
I mean, yeah, right, right.
But okay. I think they bring as best I know, a neutral expert set of eyes to anyone's situation. I mean, for instance, we moved this summer. We had a home energy audit, and we got a report at the end that said, here are the options that you could use, and they laid out the costs for each. They didn't skip, for instance, oil or propane. They just said, you know, here's what oil is, here's what propane is, here's what a heat pump is.
Yeah, okay. And so this idea of an all-fuels energy efficiency program would be essentially a statutory change now to say, hey, Efficiency Vermont, you are now allowed to kind of escape the shackles of electric only,
right,
and really talk about a wide range of stuff, right?
Right.
Okay.
And it's so you're reminding me that how did we get here? It's because last year we passed Act 62, and it did two things. It right away it said that there was an operating surplus that Efficiency Vermont had, and we said, okay, you could spend that money in weatherization in a way that they had not been allowed under law to do. Then the proceeding that's gone across, we're asking the PUC to really do a very deep dive and analysis on how we would design and implement a full-fledged all-fuels energy efficiency program. So it's not necessarily Efficiency Vermont would do it. There's no preconditions on it. Could be entirely new people would participate in delivering that. Meanwhile, we don't want to sit on our hands for a year and a half waiting for that proceeding to conclude. And so we've learned from it, and that's where this no new taxes, no mandate, entirely optional opportunity would grow out of that we're talking about today in the Energy Efficiency Modernization Bill.
With electric vehicles and the push now on here, is that being incented somewhat, though, by this sort of, I don't know whether financial incentives are in the way Efficiency Vermont is paid for, or just kind of, is there a built-in, I don't want to say bias, but certainly tradition toward, we know how to save electricity, we know how to generate electricity in a fairly renewable, low-carbon way if we want to. Is that one of the big incentives for people to be looking at electric vehicles as the solution for transportation?
Well, we have in America one of the cleanest grids in the country. So right now it's 63% renewable. If you add on other non-carbon fuels, for instance, nuclear-based, now you're up to 93% non-carbon. So here we have this great reservoir of clean power, clean electric power. So the idea is, how could you draw on that pool, that resource that we've built over the last 5 years, and say, let's deploy that as a clean way of heating, a clean way of driving.
Mm-hmm.
So it really goes hand in glove with, this would make a lot less sense if we had coal plants sitting there producing all our electricity. You wouldn't want to, you would be fooling yourself if you said, hey, I have an electric car, but down the street there's a coal-fired plant generating that electricity. What we've done over the last 5 years is move to the cleanest grid in the country. Now it really does make sense to plug into that to be heating and driving.
Of course, there are always little wrinkles here, and I haven't done the math or looked at the math lately, but I know in the case of, for instance, a big hydro, when reservoirs are drawn down and back up again, they're drawn down. You have a lot of plants which were underwater are now out in the sunlight, and the decomposition process can start, and that releases methane.
Yes.
Potent greenhouse gas.
Yeah.
In the case of nuclear, I know that at least up until 12 or 13 or so, most of the nuclear fuel in the country, the stuff that was actually in the fuel, in the containments, making the power, came from this plant in Kentucky, the Paducah plant, where they were making the nuclear fuel for our commercial reactors. They had I once read online that they had a daily or a regular demand on the grid for 3,000 megawatts. It's like the three times Vermont's entire statewide load
for this
nuclear processing that they were doing.
Right, super energy intensive.
And you can imagine where they were getting their power from in Kentucky.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess none of this stuff is pure, is I guess
what
I'm saying.
Absolutely. I mean, I agree completely. It's one of the things I like about your show. There's like no pretending that's, let's get to the facts and lay them all out and be fair about it. There's no perfectly clean energy source.
Mm-hmm.
There are just cleaner sources, and there's always trade-offs. So, right, on nuclear, there's a carbon footprint in creating the fuel for the nuclear plant. So it's not right, I think, for anyone to say it's entirely carbon-free.
Mm-hmm.
So we should always acknowledge. I mean, one of the things we do when we're taking is intensive testimony in committee is trying to make sure that we uncover all those kinds of things so that we know that we're making a best possible choice. But we never produce perfect bills in this building. We just produce better choices.
There's a Green New Deal proposed here in Vermont, and let's talk about that a little bit. What are some of the components? I think Senator Polina is the lead sponsor in the Senate.
Sure. So that I signed on to sponsor with Senator Polina, and he's taking the lead on that side. There's a House counterpart. I don't think the bills are quite the same, but you know, the basic concept is that we can build a new clean energy economy, and it involves many, many different facets, from water to food to transportation to housing to health. You know, so there's climate effects basically everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're going to be responding to that and making better choices, helping us reduce emissions, there's a lot of opportunities to act. And so I think that's that whole basket of actions is, sometimes people call that basket the Green New Deal.
And yet you were telling me, we were speaking there a little bit earlier this morning, and you were saying that many of the steps on the Green New Deal, at least as it is fashioned nationally by AOC and others, Vermont's already been doing them for a while.
Right. Yes. Well, I think, you know, I was thinking about seeing you today, and I paused and I realized, you know, some people are concern that we don't have a quote-unquote Vermont Green New Deal, but the original New Deal was a series of something like 59 bills enacted over 7 years. It wasn't just one monolithic New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
And in retrospect, you know, that's how we call it the New Deal as well, and sort of imagine it as one thing. But Vermont has this history of doing energy bills. I mean, when I said that we have the cleanest grid in America, that's not an accident. That's because it was a step to move us off of fossil fuels, clean up our grid. So if you look at that, if you look at the 20 years that we've already had the first statewide energy efficiency program in the country, that's how we've been able to reduce electrical usage in a really meaningful way. And I would say, if someone said, okay, in my Green New Deal, I want to do the equivalent of taking 240,000 cars, almost half the cars in Vermont, off the road for a decade. That's my target. You say, wow, I don't know if you could ever pull that off, but that's how much we've reduced emissions through Efficiency Vermont. So about almost half the fleet in Vermont removed from the road for 10 years. So we have some major achievements, and we are in the middle of our own New Deal, Green New Deal already.
Well, let me give you a little pushback on that. Okay. I had Elizabeth Gripkoff from BT Digger on in the first half hour of the program this morning, and we were both talking about the fact that Vermont has been slipping on moving toward its greenhouse gas reduction goals, and actually has been generating more. What's up with that?
Yeah. So there's two things that go on. As we were talking about earlier, 80% of our emissions are either transportation or thermal loads. So if you have a really cold winter, we see a bump up in fuel use. But the big one is that over the last decade, the percentage of vehicles that are higher mileage, more and more people want trucks and SUVs.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're doing is we're buying things that burn more fuel, and so we're creating more emissions.
So it's really individual behavior that's driving this,
yes.
Sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, right. In the end, if we're going to tackle this well, we can't do things to Vermonters. We have to work with Vermonters, figure out how they want to get there, and help make those changes. So on this bill I was mentioning before, the Modernization Act, 84% of Vermonters in a poll just lately said, yeah, we like that idea. You step up and get it done. So that's what we're doing right now.
All right. Well, Senator Christopher Bray, the chair of the Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committee, I want to thank you so much for coming in this morning and having a little chat here. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Always good to see you.
And we're going to go to a top of the hour break for some CBS News here on the Dave Graham Show, WDEV, FM, and AM. And by the way, folks, don't forget about our podcast. If you miss our morning program, you can always go to WDEVradio.com, follow the link to the Dave Graham Show, scroll down a bit, you'll come up with a list of our recent programs by guest and topic, and can listen any time of day or night. That's the great thing about the internet. And we thank the Warren Store, the friendly, funky, and almost world famous Warren Store, for helping us out with that podcast. We'll be back shortly, folks.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot, and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes, or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We're back for the second hour of our Friday morning program, where we broadcast during the legislative session from the State House in Montpelier. After the mid-show news that we put on at 10 o'clock from CBS News, we like to go to one of our national correspondents and talk about, pull the lens back a little bit and look for what's going on nationally. And obviously there is a rather large story we've been tracking in Washington now for, it seems like, long, long time, and that would be the impeachment now really in its sort of climactic moments there, with the trial going on in the U.S. Senate of President Donald J. Trump. And we really think it's important for our program to dig in and find out what some of the issues are there, even when we're down at the State House and we're really focusing in on Vermont news. We'll devote the next few minutes to a discussion about the impeachment situation in Washington. I think Bob Ney is going to be joining us shortly. He, of course, is one of our longtime regulars and is a real great contributor to the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. And is Bob with us yet? Bob, are you ready to go? Well, I don't know if we have quite have a connection through through to Bob Ney yet, but we are hoping to talk with Bob Ney, who's is Bob there?
Hello.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing, Dave?
And wanted to check in with you. Happy Friday, and update us on where we are in the impeachment trial down in Washington. Can we find out a little bit about the latest?
Sure, Dave. Day one was senators approved rules of the proceedings. You know, more technical, but it also got into a little bit of a more fight. McConnell wanted a little bit different, had a little stricter version, and he quote compromised on a couple pieces, including final evidence vote. They wanted more. I don't think it's a big deal. I think McConnell intentionally made it difficult, so he gave a little quote. You know, that's his job. And then the second day, the Democratic side kicked off their case with Representative Adam Schiff. He opened the hours, 24 hours, of what was a lot of Democrats opening arguments. He went to an extensive timeline of actions by Trump and other administration officials about the Ukraine issue. Now, off the floor, by the way, there was a side private conversation. And there was an idea of a witness swap. Some members of the Biden family would testify, and then some of the Trump administration officials would testify. That was kind of all nixed before it started. Mm-hmm. The third day, Schiff argued, that's Congressman Schiff, that the truth matters. And he said, okay, if you don't think it was that big a deal, but you think the president did something wrong, it's still rises to the level of impeachment. You should find him guilty. He should be removed. And then, of course, you're going to have the GOP response, which, by the way, the president is not happy. It's on Saturday. It doesn't get that much attention.
Yeah, it's weird timing, for that, that is for sure. Now, and the other thing I think people need to be aware of here, I've sensed quite a bit of excitement over the past couple of days, especially from Democrats and from people who are critical of the president. About you know what some folks are referring to as this brilliant performance by Congressman Schiff and so on, and he's been a very good and effective prosecutor. There's no doubt about that. But he is on right now. I've covered court trials before where the lawyers come in and they make their opening arguments, and you hear one side, and the lawyer's job is to convince any listener of his or her side in the case, and so when the first lawyer gets up and speaks for 15 or 20 minutes or whatever it is, you get to the end of that and you go, wow, that this person must be guilty or must be innocent or whatever. Mm-hmm. and then you hear the other side, and all of a sudden you are that little balloon you were floating on for a few minutes pops or something. I think we are, I mean, one way I described it, I think, yesterday was we're at the high watermark of the Democrats' case for impeachment here, and that we will hear the Republican response, even if it's some of it's on a Saturday, and that some of this balloon may be just a tad deflated by middle of next week. What do you think?
I think you're right. I mean, that's a good assessment. It opens that way, and then people look at one thing, and then the arguments by the president may not be seen as by as many people because they're on Saturday, but you can bet they'll get that out through different messages and media, etc. It comes to a vote and it's all done, and then we're, I think, to the election process with the Democratic side still trying to decide who their nominee is going to be, and the president still on Twitter and making headlines for various other reasons.
Yeah. I mean, he does have that that bully pulpit or whatever Twitter is. I don't really know if it's a pulpit or whatever, but he certainly is quite adept at using that to get his messages out there. Do you see anything unfolding here this week, and as the thing has gone on so far, that's a surprise to you? Do you think that Adam Schiff and the Democrats have pushed the ball down the field farther than you thought they were going to?
I mean, I don't think there's any new surprises. What we knew in the House is what's being, you know, spelled out now in the Senate. If there's no new witnesses called, then there's nothing except what the media will report in new information. So I think they've made, you know, their case from what they brought from the House over. And time will tell now if anything comes to the forefront that we don't know about between now and then. And, of course, that would bear pressure. And then the Democratic side needs four witnesses in order to, not four witnesses, four Republicans, rather, Dave, in order to call more witnesses.
Yes, and one thing that's kind of interesting here, and I don't know whether there's any prospect for this, but I mean, it's theoretically possible that the House could actually pass more articles of impeachment and send them over to the Senate at some point. Correct?
Well, yes, they could. I mean, if they wanted to, you know, they could do that.
And the reason I ask that is because since the December 18th passage of the two articles that are now, involved in this trial in the Senate right now, we've had a couple things come out. One was that the president tweeted or retweeted the identification of the whistleblower. And that is something which I'm told is actually a violation of federal law right there. A second thing I've noticed in just this past week, the Washington Post had a pretty amazing story about inauguration night back in 2017, where the president pretty clearly, it looked like a violation of the emoluments clause, where the Trump Hotel there in Washington was hosting one of the inaugural events or trying to. It turned out to be not very well attended, and then there were these charges for renting the hall and so on that seemed to be way beyond normal market rates and so on and so forth, as in a little bit of profiteering off the presidency going on. I mean, could these things or any other stuff that comes out that the president is doing or has done post December 18th end up with more articles of impeachment?
Well, I doubt it, because it would take such a process to do that, unless it's something extremely unusual that we don't know about. I just don't see, Dave, where the House side's going to be willing to do that.
Yeah.
You know, they had a lot of arguments about what they even did, what they were bringing up. I just don't see anything new, unless it's, like I said, record-breaking. I don't see anything new being brought forth.
I suppose he could. I don't know. Maybe shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue. I only mentioned that because he suggested it at one point. So
that might be impeachable. I predict.
What? Say again.
No matter what he says, that might be impeachable.
That might get another article of impeachment. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see. The Senate probably still deliver a non. Guilty verdict or not remove him from office. I don't know. But, well, Bob May, I appreciate you bringing us up this morning.
You.
It's always good chatting with you. I think
I
really enjoy these conversations. Let's do it again next week.
I do too. Thank you.
Wanted to bring in next guest, Timothy Briglin is the representative from Thetford. He's a Democrat and chairs the House Energy and Technology Committee. And he's going to talk to us a little bit about the Global Warming Solutions Act. And Representative Briglin, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
No, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
All righty. And so tell us, what is the Global Warming Solutions Act?
Well, first of all, I didn't give the bill that name.
Okay.
There are Global Warming Solutions Acts, as they've come to be called, in a number of states around the Northeast as well as out on the West Coast. And just to put this bill in context, the first day of session, as I was driving up to Montpelier, I opened my briefcase when I got into the State House, and my wife had tucked a comic strip in my bag, and it was this old New Yorker comic, which was a kind of a favorite of ours. And it's this PhD math student and this math professor standing at a board, a chalkboard with all these different math formulas written all over it. And in the middle of the chalkboard, with a circle around it, it read, "And then a miracle occurs." And the math professor points to the student and says, "I think you need a little more work here."
Yeah.
And essentially, that's been Vermont's climate policy for the past 15 or 20 years. We shuffle our feet. We pass a resolution that says we're serious about getting to work on addressing climate issues, and then we essentially hope for a miracle. And I think in the last 12 to 18 months, the reason this has become even more of an important issue is because of what's going on in Washington, or what's not going on in Washington. We've got a president who not only won't address the issue, but is moving us in the opposite direction. And I think there's a meaningful chance that President Trump is going to be reelected. So we may have another 4 years of not only inaction, but moving in the wrong direction on where we are with fossil fuels. And then, the second thing that we're coming to realize is that with where the science tells us we are, where we are today, there's a lot of reasons why we can't wait more time to plan and work on this. There are economic reasons. There are reasons related to our planet being on fire, almost literally, as you look at what's going on in California and Australia. And the thing we wish we had was more time, and we don't have it. Where Vermont is about 15 years ago, we passed a set of goals in the state as to where we were going to set targets for reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. We haven't even come close to reaching them. In 2017, to his credit, Governor Scott stepped forward and said, in spite of the Trump administration pulling the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord, Vermont as a state is going to be, we are going to meet those targets. And he joined with another 24 states in the U.S. climate initiative to pursue as a group 24 states, which would be the sixth largest country in the world, that we would pursue those targets. But we still haven't set a plan. We still don't have a strategy to get there. What the Global Warming Solutions Act does, and again, this is a reflection of work that's gone on in other states, is it looks at two things that are necessary in climate action. One is mitigation, putting a stake in the ground that says we will be accountable to this level of greenhouse gas emission reduction as a state, and I'll go through very specifically what those levels are. Also importantly, it looks at resiliency. For the next 30, 40 years, whatever we do in terms of greenhouse gas emission reduction, the weather is going to get worse in this state. We are going to have more natural disasters. We are going to have more severe weather events. How as a state are we preparing for that? So climate action is, how do we live in a world in the coming decades where we're going to be faced with a more severe weather planet? And it's also, how do we reduce our greenhouse gas emissions so that 80 years from now, our children and grandchildren have a planet that is habitable? So it's those two things that we're looking at. The primary goalposts, if you will, in this legislation are setting up what the targets are that we are legally beholden to meeting. And just to go over those real quickly, the first is in 2025, where we will be beholden to the Paris climate goals of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions by 26% relative to our 2005 emission levels. And then in 2030 and in 2050, where we will be beholden to reducing our greenhouse gas emissions level in concert with what our comprehensive energy plan says as a state.
Okay, what's the stick? What happens if we don't meet those goals?
So the second, you call it a stick, but accountability mechanism here is that if we don't, a citizen can step forward and say, "Hey, Vermont, you haven't met these goals." The state of government, our regulatory agencies, can be held accountable through a remedy that a judge would bring forward saying, Vermont, you've got to do more. You've got to regulate more. You've got to do things that are in line with the guidelines set up by this this act. So, and some of the details, and I neglected to bring up one very important part of this, which is there has been no planning, no strategic framework in Vermont as to how do we go forward and meet these reduction goals. What we've been doing in recent years is kind of throwing spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks. You know, a little weatherization here, kind of sprinkling some EV incentive dollars here, but there is no there's no plan that we have as a state. And you know, a vision or a goal without a plan to get there is essentially a hallucination, and that's where we are as a state right now. So we need thoughtful planning as a state as to what are the specific things that we are going to do to get from here to there. That's also part of this act.
And is it going to be the responsibility fall mainly to the Agency of Natural Resources or the Department of Public Service, or who actually is going to be accountable here?
Yeah, that is the main thrust. The Agency of Natural Resources, as we stand here today, has pretty broad jurisdiction as to how they regulate pollutants, air pollutants in this case, which greenhouse gas emissions. So there is authority there. We are expanding that here. But we are also bringing folks from across state government, Agency of Transportation, Agency of Human Services, emergency management. As I said, resiliency is an important part of this.
Mm-hmm.
Agency of Agriculture, and as you mentioned, Agency of Natural Resources. There's no kind of cross-state planning on policy. The other thing that's important here is I don't want to give an indication that if we're fortunate enough to pass laws this term that kind of set these stakes in the ground, that the legislature is kind of off the hook. There is plenty of legislation that we are and policy that we're going to have to pass as a state in coming years that relate to, you know, funding that we're going to have to go forward with that works in concert with a state plan that brings forward statutory authority that's going to be necessary for transportation, for you know, for these other agencies that I'd mentioned. What this bill does is it sets up a framework. It sets a foundation under state government saying these are things that we are going to do and we are going to be beholden to. And we look to the citizens of Vermont, if we don't get there, to hold us responsible.
Should there be in the executive branch some kind of a climate czar who could coordinate the efforts of the Agency of Natural Resources, the Agency of Agriculture, Department of Public Service, and I think I'm forgetting one that you mentioned, but if you know what I mean, so that people know, have a sort of line of authority and someone to hold responsible if the goals aren't met.
So one of the suggestions that we've gotten from the huge amount of testimony we've taken in the last couple of weeks on this bill, and in fact this morning from Sue Minter, who's done a great deal of work on this, was that we need to elevate the work of this Climate Council to working with the agency of administration, which if you study state government, you know, is kind of the first among equals of agencies that report to the governor.
Yep.
And right now, the way the bill is structured, it would be the Agency of Natural Resources that plays that kind of lead role. Mm-hmm. And so something my committee will be looking at in the coming days is do we need to push this even higher in the administration? You know, in terms of your suggestion of, you know, do we need a climate czar? I think that would be terrific if that was something that the governor did. That's more of an executive action, but we are trying to raise this to the highest level of attention in state government that we can.
And the Global Warming Solutions Act, I mean, if you mentioned that a judge might be involved in holding folks accountable. We're really talking about citizen lawsuits, right?
That could happen. Could happen. But I also want to be clear that what this bill would do is it's not citizens suing citizens. It's not citizens suing you know, the guy down the street who's got a big diesel truck. This is citizens holding their government accountable for statutory obligations that we're setting out. So it's looking to the government. You know, if there is if there is judicial action here, we're trying to make it narrow and focused, and the remedies focused on a court saying to state government, you got to do more.
All right. Well, Representative Timothy Briglin, you've got a full plate there at the House Energy and Natural Energy and Technology Committee, and I really appreciate you coming by and sharing with us some of what you've been up to. It's interesting stuff.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
All righty. We're going to go to a bottom of the hour news break for some CBS News, a couple words from our sponsors, and we're going to let Timothy Briglin get back to the House floor for, I think we're voting on minimum wage this morning. So, all right, we'll be back with more of the Dave Graham Show just after this break at the bottom of the hour, folks. Stay with us.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store, we're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We're back here on the Dave Graham Show, and we are glad to tell you that our next guest is Representative Amy Sheldon. She's a Democrat from Middlebury, and she chairs the House Natural Resources Committee, a committee that has been really steeped for the past like more than a year now, I think, in Act 250, and has been digging into this 50-year-old land use law in Vermont, and recently has been dealing with what could be some huge changes in the way Act 250 has operated in the state. Representative Sheldon, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
You're welcome, Dave. Thanks for having me.
And I should warn listeners, by the way, that Amy Sheldon might have to jump up off the couch here outside the State House cafeteria and run into the House floor for a roll call. If the bell goes off here paging her, then she'll disappear, and I guess I'll just have to filibuster or something for the next few minutes. But we hope the bell will hold off and we can get a little conversation about Act 250. We talked about a year ago about Act 250 reform legislation here, and in broad strokes, because it was in the very beginning of the process. And I remember some of the discussion was about, for instance, trying to encourage more development in our village centers and downtowns, and discourage development in sparsely populated farm fields and mountainsides and so on. Is that still part of the goal?
Yeah, that's very foundational to the goals of the historic goals 50 years ago, and I think Vermonters today agree that those are still the major goals for our land use policy. And that's thanks for bringing that up, because we've been distracted with a big proposal, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But I think it's important to remember the big picture here is that we're trying to set Vermonters up for the next 50 years.
And it is interesting to me, because if you compare development patterns in Vermont really over the with what's gone on in other parts of the country, it really is considerably different from what you see in around town centers and the outlying areas where you see so much more sprawl in other states. Just going to pretty much any small, medium-sized town in the country, you'll see just a lot more kind of random development on roadsides and so on. Vermont, not so much. And how much do you credit Act 250 for that?
I think I credit it a lot for that. I think it's given us a frame that has really a foundational shared common language around understanding the importance of dense development in our downtowns and surrounded by the working rural landscape.
In the now, you talked about a big proposal. We do have to get there, and I want to before, especially if you're going to suddenly have to jump and run. Let's go ahead. There was a proposal launched a couple weeks ago by both the governor and the Vermont Natural Resources Council, which would have the historic structure of Act 250, of course, relied on district commissions to take a first look at a development project in their areas, and there was an appeal process up to environmental board, environmental court. It's changed a little bit over time. But essentially, the first stage historically has been with the district environmental commissions around the state. I believe there are, what, nine of them?
There are nine of them currently.
And this proposal that was launched by the governor and by VNRC the other day would have those go away and be replaced by a statewide board, which sort of struck me. I looked at the proposal and I said, is this kind of similar to the Public Utility Commission?
Well, there's certainly some parallels, and folks, there are certain people who believe that it is very much a similar type of process. We've spent the first, the better part of the first few weeks of the session evaluating this proposal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it represents respect for some of the main priorities that are in our underlying committee bill that we worked on. You alluded to that. That committee bill was a result of a long-range planning process, really, of a couple of years where we did a lot of public outreach and took a lot of testimony and made recommendations in a draft bill that we reviewed last session. This proposal that's on the table represents the work of, as you mentioned, the administration and VNRC looking at some of the areas that are identified as priorities in our underlying bill and trying to address them, in some instances identically, in some instances with pretty big differences. And we're exploring where we find areas of overlap. And, you know, our committee's in the process of evaluating the big change that you mentioned around how projects are reviewed and the sort of fate of the district commissions. I will say that we've taken a lot of very compelling testimony this week on the current state of those commissions and the importance of them to the Act 250 process.
I remember reading in some national publication, it might have been the New York Times or Washington Post or someplace like that, a couple of years ago, kind of extolling the citizen involvement that is involved in a district commission hearing around the state on these land use issues. And it did sort of create an interesting flavor, almost an aura or something, around the way Vermont approaches this kind of stuff. And do you feel like there would be a loss of that if we decided to go to a statewide sort of public service board or, public utility commission model?
I think there's a pretty big risk of that, and I think we are looking to, you know, in the next day or next few days, decide if there's enough in this proposal for us to pursue it. The good thing about the proposal is it leads us to areas of agreement. You mentioned, you know, around 2005, there were significant changes in the way that the board was structured and the appeals process happened.
Mm-hmm.
Many people agree that there could be some improvements in at the board level, and I think.
Now, by the board there, you mean the environmental board, is that right?
Currently called the Natural Resources Board, but formerly the Environmental Board.
Yep.
It changed the name and the power of it. The authority of it changed in 2005,
mm-hmm.
And so there's area we agree that's something that needs to be worked on, and how we do that is what we're working out now.
Yeah. Now, do you expect that? I'm trying to figure out. I probably should put this question to the administration. They're not here right now, so I'll ask you what you're hearing. Are you hearing a pretty tough stance on their part that we've got to have this change where we eliminate the district commissions, or there's really no go here, or are they saying, hey, this is just a suggestion for you to think about?
I can't speak for them. What I know is that we, you know, as a committee, are taking time, even as soon as this afternoon, to talk about how the strengths that we see in the proposal, the weaknesses, and how we want to move forward.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there is support on the committee for this idea of really streamlining this process?
I can't tell you. I'm sorry to say that. But I guess one thing I would love to say is that I do think there's areas of opportunity in the more substantive parts of the bill. You know, the big things we agree on are that we need to protect Vermont's environment for the future, including resilience of climate change,
mm-hmm.
by protecting forest blocks and habitat connectivity, addressing climate change and our larger developments. I think that we agree on that with the administration. And And flip side of that is we agree that we want to encourage development in our downtowns, and we're looking for ways of doing that. And I look at that as the core of this bill. I think there's certainly administrative issues that need to be addressed, and we're working through the details of the best way to do that now.
Here in Montpelier on a municipal level, there's been some debate about a proposed parking garage, new hotel downtown. I'm sure you're at least passingly familiar with some of that stuff. How would a rewritten Act 250, especially around downtown issues, affect a local debate like that?
Yeah, that development has come up a little. I would say I'm a little bit familiar with it. The idea would be that towns that have a designated downtown or neighborhood development area designation would be exempt from Act 250. That's kind of in this proposal that we're evaluating. There's a very similar element in our underlying bill that we looked at last year. In general, I think there's support for that kind of a move. The testimony we've taken would say that the risk is that some of the larger developments do have regional impacts, and understanding the regional impacts that and how those would need to be addressed if we do delegate this authority. Essentially, I see it as a delegation. So as towns who've done their good planning and have met statewide land use goals don't have to go through another iteration of review on that.
One of the things that you mentioned was the climate aspect here, and of course, nobody really, I don't know if anybody ever spoke about climate change back when Act 250 was passed in 1970, and I'm just wondering, where do we stand on that? Are there new criteria? I know there, you know, the longstanding criteria in Act 250 about traffic and about energy use and other issues where developments affect a wide range of environmental issues. Would there be new criteria listed in the actual statute under this bill that would address climate change?
There are. I mean, and we in our underlying bill, we talk about greenhouse gas emissions and trying to mitigate those both through criterion 5, which is transportation, creating a new criteria 1 that would focus on air and include greenhouse gases. The administration takes a slightly different approach and adds more of a climate resiliency criteria, so we're going to look at that and understand what that looks like. How we look at our river corridors is an issue related to climate change. You know, we know we're having increased flooding and flood risks. We're making some forward progress on that, integrating a potentially like a better review of river corridors statewide over time is one of the proposals that's on the table. So absolutely, the whole point of the 50-year look is, say, climate change wasn't addressed in the original bill, although interestingly, those foundational land use goals that we share as Vermonters, by their definition, I think set us up for not just avoiding the sprawl that other states have seen, but also a more resilient landscape in the face of climate change.
Yeah, because the thing we don't want is for our rivers and our streets to become one. I mean, I'm always remarking on the fact that you drive around the state and there's a brook road here and there's a river street there. And occasionally we have these situations where the river is the street or the street is the river, and it's kind of a mess, and we want to limit that. So
that's
important stuff.
That's absolutely right. We need to limit that.
Representative Amy Sheldon, thank you so much for stopping by this morning here on the Dave Graham Show. Really happy to talk with you.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
Now Jim McCullough joins us. He's a longtime rep from the town of Williston, just outside Burlington, and he's a Democrat, and I believe he's a member, I'll double check with him, of the Natural Resources Committee as well. Representative McCullough, thanks for joining me.
You are absolutely welcome.
And are you a member of that committee these days?
I've been a member of Natural Resources and Natural Resources Fish and Wildlife for 16 of my 18 years here.
Wow. Okay. I thought you'd been there. I just wasn't sure if you were still on that panel or exactly what. But one of the reasons I wanted to have you on this morning is because I understand, you know, we've been hearing a little bit about the reasons for that some folks might want to consider elimination of the district commissions. They create an extra layer of bureaucracy in the estimation of some. Others say, well, it's really a matter of bringing in citizen involvement in a very, very, very early part of a review process for big projects in Vermont. Where do you come down on this?
Well, I don't believe that, first of all, I guess I want to invoke a long Vermont held value. Don't fix it if it's not broken. And we haven't gotten any evidence that it's the district commissions that are broken.
Mm-hmm.
It's perhaps a bureaucracy. And when I say that, I don't say that in a bad way. I mean, we have a system that requires redundancy, which benefits everybody. It benefits citizens, it benefits developers, and when that sometimes gets tiring and messy, squeaky wheels start to squeak.
Yeah.
So I'm maintaining the district commissions are not the problem. It's the ability for people to get their voices heard again a second time, and the time that it takes to do that and the expense that it takes to do that, and I fully recognize that through our appeals process. And what part of appeals do we not like? I mean, if
Well, I've heard the argument for years now that sometimes the appeals process can effectively give people who are opposed to a project, quote unquote, too many bites at the apple. Mm-hmm. You know, they can go into the district commission, raise their issues there, and then if they're going, I guess these days they go to the environmental court, is it, or how does that system actually? Can you walk me through a little bit? Because I've grown hazy over the years after the change from the Natural Resources Board, to the Environmental Board to the Natural Resources Board, et cetera. So what is the appeals process like in Act 250 these days?
Well, I guess it depends who you talk to. I think everybody will agree it's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody will agree that it's good for attorneys. And I think that most people will agree that a second bite at an apple is not all that bad a thing.
I like apples, and I usually take a second bite when I'm having an apple.
And we'll use that as
third or fourth.
Yeah, that's the metaphor, though.
Mm-hmm.
That if you're aggrieved, you get an opportunity as a citizen, and surely developers are citizens that own businesses. They get a chance as well.
And that's an important point. I think some you hear from the development folks out there that they feel kind of aggrieved, that they feel like there's too much standing in the way when they want to build a project. They don't mind a certain level of review, but how thick is it?
Right.
How many times do they have to go through it?
Right.
How much are the legal bills going to be?
Right. So then this is an intractable discussion. That deviates us from the main thought that Act 250 was built on citizen participation in the local communities. And when we centralize Act 250, even in Montpelier, let's just call it in Montpelier, and dissect our local people's voices from that process, which is what one of the foundations of Act 250 is built on, with differing commissions in different areas, we have thrown the baby out with the bathwater.
Hmm. Well, so it sounds like you're not a fan of this idea of eliminating the district commissions. You want to preserve them.
I do. I would also like to make them function better, because I think the issue is, can't we all do better in everything? And I'm very sure there's changes that can be made to the district commissions without throwing them away.
All right. Well, Representative Jim McCullough, a member of the Vermont House Natural Resources and Fish and Wildlife Committee, I really appreciate you joining me this morning.
It's been my pleasure, David.
Alrighty. Hey, we are fast approaching the top of the hour, which means the end of this edition of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM. Thanks for listening, folks. I really appreciate all the listeners out there, and want to mention that we'll be back with another edition of our show on Monday. Going to be at the farm show up in the Champlain Valley Expo next Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So that'll be some fun stuff. With the farm show is always a good thing. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre of Common Sense Radio. Have a great day, everybody.